Today's program is brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit culinarycenter.com.
I'm Linda Palaccio, host of A Taste of the Past. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Radio Cherry Bomb, coming to you live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Julia Tertian. Off the air, I write about food, and my favorite part of what I do is finding out the stories behind great recipes, restaurants, and more. On the air, I get to bring the pages of Cherry Bomb magazine to life by having these conversations with some of the most interesting women in the world of food. You can listen to the show live every Monday at 1 o'clock on heritageradionetwork.org or download it anytime on iTunes. On today's show, I'm joined by probably the most interesting woman in the world of food, the distinguished Mimi Sheridan. Mimi, I know you've spoken openly about the sort of schlep of going to Brooklyn, so first and foremost, I just want to thank you for making the trip to Bushwick to come on.
Well, I'm delighted to be here, really, because this is my native borough.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when you grow up in Brooklyn, the thing you want to do is get out of Brooklyn. I think it's very different being someone who chooses to live here.
That's so
and
funny.
I remember the novelist Erwin Shaw once said about Brooklyn College, which he went to during the Depression, it was great, it was free, and it taught me everything I had to know to get out of Brooklyn. So for me, Brooklyn was a training ground, and it's nice to see people coming back by choice.
That's so funny. My mother and her sisters grew up in Brooklyn, also in Flatbush, where I know you're from, and they all made the same decision to leave, and I think they get a big kick out of the fact that I chose to live here.
You're coming around again.
Absolutely. For anyone who's listening to the show who might not be who might not be familiar with your impressive career, I've made a sort of abbreviated greatest hits. You're the former restaurant critic of the New York Times. You were the first woman to ever hold that position. You've written extensively for every notable magazine, including The New Yorker, Vogue, Vanity Fair. You're a noted author of many books. We're counting, it's around 16, 17, possibly 18.
16, I think. Eight, probably you could count 18 with one coming out in January in a new edition.
Yeah.
That has just come out.
Yeah, I think the German cookbook can hold two.
I think so, too.
Some of your books have won many awards, including the IACP Award, the James Beard Award. I think what sums up your sort of career mostly was the great declaration that Jean-Georges von Gerichten said about you. He said that of Mimi Sheridan, her knowledge knows no bounds. Her glossary of flavors is ultimate. Her opinion is like gold.
Isn't he lovely? I like him, too.
He's a charming
and I
guy.
Love his restaurants. And it's very, very flattering to have someone like that say something.
Absolutely. No, it's a real, I think it sums
instead
it all up.
Instead of what T.S. Eliot called the approval of fools.
That's so funny. You know, it's good to have someone whose opinion counts for a lot.
Exactly.
You were talking about you're from Brooklyn. Is it true? I just wanted to ask. Your father worked. Is it true he worked in wholesale produce, but
he didn't
like vegetables?
He hated vegetables except potatoes and corn. He liked and onions, but nothing green. And he used to say to my mother in Yiddish so that my brother and I would not understand. They thought, don't give me any vegetables, nish kein grüne, he would say. So immediately we knew that was the only plate that didn't have any vegetables. So that's what he must be saying. However, he taught me a great deal about discernment because he would come home at night and talk about the various fruits and vegetables that he handled during the day. And he had very strong opinions. For example, California oranges, but not Florida oranges. But Florida grapefruit and not California grapefruit. And you could not have good apples from the West Coast because there weren't enough cold nights. So the best apples for him came from New York and Massachusetts, and they still do for me. So I think what I learned was not everything is alike, and you taste and you compare. And although I never thought of having a career in food, I guess I drifted naturally once I began working on magazines.
Oh, it sounds like it was very much in your fabric.
That, yeah. Plus the fact that my mother was an excellent cook, and we talked about the food while we were eating it. I didn't like the way you make it this time, make it last time. This has too much this is perfect. So I guess I learned to be a critic at my family's
without
table.
Without even realizing it. That's so funny. Ruth Rachel was on the show recently, and she was talking about sort of discussing stories and food and all that at her dinner table, and it sounds sort of similar, but her mother wasn't a great cook, I guess, is the difference.
No, I remember her mother was famously not a great cook.
I was wondering, you went to NYU in the 1940s. I was wondering if college was something that was expected of you, or was that something that you pushed to do?
I never had to push. It was always assumed that I would go to college. It was also assumed in a strange way for the time that I would have a career. What are you going to be when you grow up? Although everyone assumed I'd get married and have children, my parents, maybe because I was the oldest child and was that for 8 years, so all of their ambitions were transferred to me. But there never was a question that I was going to be something, whether it was an airline stewardess or a model or a doctor, which I really wanted to be, or a writer. So I just wandered around from one thing that was fun to another, and here I am.
And here you are, still having fun. I think that's so great that they were so, not just supportive, but it was just...
They would not, however. It would have been a terrible, terrible fight, and I should have fought it, to go to out-of-town college. Mm. That was something very rare for a middle-class Jewish girl in those days. I think only one or two of my friends went to someplace like Penn State or University of Wisconsin. We lived in Brooklyn. I went to NYU. I commuted. But however, after my sophomore year, I got married. I eloped. And though my parents were paying for school, I didn't want them to support me. So I switched to night school for my last 2 years and got a job. And really very important, got an apartment in Greenwich Village because that was near NYU where I would be taking night classes. And that was 69 years ago, and I'm now looking at my 70th year in Greenwich Village.
Wow, amazing.
So from a one-room basement to owning my own townhouse in 70 years, which is not exactly the fast track.
That's so funny. I used to live in the West Village, and you're very much a fixture in the neighborhood.
I love it. I really do love it.
I wanted to skip ahead a few years to your time at the New York Times when you were named the first woman food critic there. You held that position for 8 years, is that right?
Yes.
So it was the late 70s through, you stepped
down
in
70. 19. I got there in 75, became a critic in 76, and my last day was the last day of 83. Mm.
What would you say was the role of the critic then, and what do you think it is now? Are they the same or different?
I think they're the same. I think what my view of it is you try to help people pick a restaurant, tell them what to expect when they get there. And that is plain and simply what it was about then, and it's about now, even though the material changes, just as a theater critic isn't always critiquing Shakespeare.
Sure,
So you have to play the hand you're dealt in terms of what's going on in your field. And although it looks more hectic now, there were plenty of new restaurants opening and closing and new cuisines coming in. I'm not sure of the rate at which they were happening, but I don't think it's much different. But I think what is different now is the critical field in that social media and the consumer-based restaurant reviews like Yelp and even Zagat, Urban Spoon, has changed the climate a bit because they do carry some weight. And there are more voices, which I would have appreciated because it was a lot of pressure to be the critic at the New York Times. New York Magazine had some clout, but not nearly as much. So I think I prefer more voices.
So you're pro chorus.
I'm pro chorus. Yeah. Let's hear what everybody thinks.
Yeah, that's terrific. I'm wondering if you felt any particular pressure at the time being a woman in such a prominent role, or did that not factor into your...
Well, I'll tell you, I was delighted because a number of years before, when Craig Claiborne left and they were looking for critics, I had already been writing about food. And I wanted to be interviewed for the job. And the word was out from some really prominent people at the Times that they did not want a woman. And the interesting thing was that the style editor, who was in charge of this department, was a big feminist. And she still thought, I believe, and I think some people still do, that there's a certain cachet to a man writing, you know, man about town, debonair,
sure.
From the age of Lucius Beebe, who was, you know, a long ago critic. So the Times wouldn't even interview me, and I went to Now, and Now wouldn't do, National Organization, mm-hmm. They wouldn't do anything. They said, well, we've had some other arguments, we're not going to fight this. And I asked all the women who might have been likely in the field, not one had been interviewed. And then a few years later, there I was, because by that time, I had had several years at New York Magazine. And the editor noted those pieces and called and asked me to come over. However, that was not the critic's job at that time. John Kennedy was still the critic. But they promised me that when he left, I would have it. And that happened just a few months. I did the column when he went on vacation. And when he came back, he said, you should have this right away. You do it so much more seriously, because he was the paper's art critic. And Craig Claiborne didn't want to be restaurant critic, so John took that on. So a few months later, he stepped down, and I stepped up.
Wow, that's so wonderful. So would you say that time at New York Magazine, in between that first, when you were first sort of interested in the position until you got the position, that was pretty pivotal?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. New York Magazine was the most fun I've ever had. It was in the early days. Clay Felker was mm-hmm. there. He was very brave. You could do an awful lot of things. And I loved that. I was freelance, but I was on contract.
That's so great.
And I was not really the critic, because Gail Green was that, but I wrote about a lot of other things. And now and then I did do criticism, and she would yell and complain, and he would apologize, but the next time he would let me do it again. But I think the piece I did for them that got me the most quickest attention was called I Tasted Everything in Bloomingdale's mm-hmm. Food Department, and that was something like 1,192 items. And
yeah.
that set me up for 1,000 foods to eat before
sure,
you die.
Yeah. I think that I wrote down... It was 1,196 yeah. is the number I found. I think that sounded unbelievable. I had some questions about that. I was going to ask you in a bit. I think that those early days of New York Magazine sound really pivotal. I personally feel connected. My mom's career in the magazine industry started at New York Magazine. I think she worked with you on a bagel story once
oh,
upon
really?
A time.
Really?
And my mom's family ran a bread bakery in Flatbush called Rat Chicks. I think my uncle may have brought you around to different bagelries around New York.
Rat Chicks.
Avenue J and 15th Street.
Yeah, but are you related to, who was the art director at Condé Rochelle?
Yeah, it was my mother.
Oh, of course. I remember from Cherry Bowl. Yeah, we shopped at that bakery.
Yeah.
It was right near the public library
mm-hmm.
I used to
yeah.
go to on 15th Street.
That's so funny. But I think New York Magazine right then, and Ms. coming out of it, I think especially for women, it was
yeah,
a really important
absolutely.
Place to be.
Absolutely. Yeah. And they brought Ms. out. Oh, the first yeah. issue of Ms. came out in New York Magazine.
Mm. Too funny. Yeah. Small world, right? I'm wondering, in your opinion, what's the current playing field like for women in both media and in food? Do you think it's more level than it used to be? Do you feel hopeful about those industries for women?
Industries in what capacity? As writers or as chefs or as restaurateurs?
All of
Very
them.
Tough for chefs, mm-hmm. I think. And a lot of it has to do with what happens to women as chefs, because I know many who have been very successful and just retired because they couldn't stand it anymore. They wanted a life. I think one of the things that makes it difficult for women, especially if they're married, is that a husband who isn't in the business is much less happy, much more unhappy about being left alone every night for dinner than a wife who, quote-unquote, knows her place mm-hmm. and stays home with the kids while daddy works in his restaurant. I think that level of tolerance is very different for women. And I know several who have just said, I want a life. I mean, you can, you know, like Joyce Goldstein, Eileen Rosenzweig, all those women did not have to leave, but finally tired of it. As for writers, I think there are many influential women food writers, but I am interested in the fact that other than Ruth Reichel and me, and for a very brief time, Marion mm-hmm. Burroughs, the New York Times has just been using one man after the other for that particular mm-hmm. role. It is, in some ways, perhaps a little easier for a man to get someone to go with him or to go alone to review a restaurant, but I never really found it a problem to get people.
It's interesting. It seems like it comes down for you to a lot of sort of personal decisions in the day-to-day life of these roles, as opposed to sort of big...
It's very demanding. For example, yeah. 1983, which was my last full year at the New York Times, I had dinner home 5 times in the entire year.
Wow.
That would be like Christmas, New Year's, Easter, my husband's birthday, Mother's Day. Mm-hmm. I felt I had to go out every Saturday night, because that's the time that the Bridge and Tunnel crowd comes in celebrating an anniversary, a birthday, and mm-hmm. they get very short shrift. Mm-hmm. And so I felt I had to see it from that standpoint. And I went many times to a restaurant. The Times never said, you know, never called me on it. I went as many as 12 times to one wow. restaurant before I reviewed it.
It's so interesting. I think so much of your work is defined by the research you do. And speaking of that article about Bloomingdale's, I read in a New York Times article about you that appeared in 2004, Alex Witchell said that the backbone of your criticism has always been your rock-solid reporting. The landmark article for New York Magazine you wrote, you tested 1,196 items from Bloomingdale's food department. It took you 11 months to do that.
That's right. That's, every week they sent, I went over and picked out another category, and the food buyer sent it to my house. I brewed 96 cups of tea. They had 96 varieties of tea. It was interesting that almost all the gourmet food in those days was packaged. Huh. Other than the charcuterie and the cheeses and the bakery, there were no fresh fruits and exotic vegetables in Macy's or Bloomingdale's, which were the two very big gourmet yeah. food stores. Canned bouillabaisse, canned game that tasted like it was packed in lighter fluid. I mean, but I think what makes me do the research is I'm sort of insecure, and I'm afraid that if I don't know everything, I won't know anything.
That's so interesting. So you find out literally everything.
It's hard
everything.
To stop.
Yeah. I'm curious, because I feel like I can say this sort of firsthand, I guess, being a working writer. I think a lot of what's published these days gets moved very quickly. And I think that the kind of time that you put into researching your pieces, I'm wondering if you think of that kind of time is still available these days. I feel like it would be hard to get a magazine or a book publisher to finance the expenses and the time it would take to produce a story like the Bloomingdale story. Do you think those pieces can still
well,
be written?
Well, it didn't cost them anything to finance it other than paying me for the story. Bloomingdale sent the food. We were very open about mm-hmm. that. Workman, which has stood by me for 10 years while I worked on 1,000 Foods mm-hmm. to Eat, just, you know, it was an advance. And when the book came out, the book, they were spectacular. I thought they would pull the plug any minute, but they never did. I think it depends on the medium you're working in,
sure.
what the time span is.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And I wouldn't do it any other way. If someone wanted me, well, after the 1,000, all the food in Bloomingdale's, I had a letter from Fauchon in Paris asking if I would like to come over for a weekend and taste everything at Fauchon.
A weekend.
And I, that's what got me. And Sherry Lehman asked me to taste all the liquor. And I thought, that's going to be the end of my
you
liver.
Can write a story about hangovers. what you do to cure them. I was curious, too, about your writing style, because to me, I think, especially as a critic, you had a very sort of declarative writing style. What do you make of the more story-driven style that seems to narrate sort of not just criticism, but all food writing these days?
In criticism, I dislike it intensely. Mm. I think it makes places sound hip and fun, even if they're not very good, that it's about something else. For me, a restaurant is about going out and eating. I allow, of course, for different atmospheres, for different occasions,
sure.
Different levels. You know, I loved Sammy's
Romanian
Jewry in its day as much as I love La Grenouille. And I don't like too much. I think there are a group of readers who do like those stories. And I think the problem becomes when you have a core audience that's really interested in the subject, you can be very specific and detailed. But when you're working for a publication that wants to expand that audience, then you have to get people who are less interested, and you have to entertain them in another way, thereby angering your core audience.
Sure.
So what is all this crap?
Yeah.
You know, I want to know. And it was very interesting to me when I left the Times. The editor I worked for got a lot of mail about me leaving, and the most vociferous were from academics who appreciated what I did. And in fact, in the book Teacher Man, Frank McCourt had a whole chapter on my reviews when he was teaching English at Stuyvesant.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Every Friday, the class was given the assignment to read my review and to go to the cafeteria and do a Mimi Sheraton on the review. I was stunned. I mean, I hadn't seen this book. My cousin called from Norfolk and people were calling, did you see this? Did you see? And he explained what was good about them. And that to me was very, very gratifying because they were quite specifically
wow.
about the restaurant. That's... And he saw something in them that I'm not sure I even understand.
Wow.
Because I don't write trying to attract that kind. I am very careful to make it extremely plain what I mean and to give the reader as much help as he or she needs to make a choice, whether it's a restaurant or bagels or Bialy's, like that.
Absolutely.
I write for myself. I guess I write what I want to read.
Mm. That's a pretty great way to do that. I had another question about your writing, which is, I think you're very well known for not being afraid to express your opinions.
True.
I found a non-food example of this, which was a short interview you did with a West Village-based blog, and you said about NYU that, I'll just quote your lines here. You said, "I hate NYU because they're destroying Greenwich Village. I've lived here 65 years. I'm a property owner, and I deplore what NYU is doing to the village. I'm not at all proud of being a graduate." You can put that in the article. I was wondering, does being outspoken, is that something that runs in your family? Where does that come from?
I thought it came from being from Brooklyn.
I'll have to ask my mother.
That's what I've been told yeah. several times.
So it's just in your your background.
I think maybe yeah. Brooklyn
people are.
It's a
product of your place. That's so funny. How do you feel when your opinions are disagreed with?
Annoyed.
That is so funny. That's pretty great. I think we're going to take a quick break here. I think that's a good note to take a break on, and we're going to be right back after the break.
The International Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
Hi, and welcome back to Radio Cherry Bomb. I'm your host, Julia Tertian, and I'm back with Mimi Sheridan. Mimi, I want to talk about your books very much, but first I wanted to ask you a few questions about New York. You're a lifelong New Yorker, which we were talking about earlier. You've seen so many restaurants come and go and old ones close and get reborn. I was thinking about the example of how Babbo is now located where the Coach House used to be. I love the way you referred to the sort of changing landscape in an interview you did with Eater. You said that you see this whole city as a double exposed photograph. I thought that was so well put. I'm wondering, are there any particular restaurants you wish were still open?
Ones that goodness, yes.
A long list.
I would certainly say Seafair of the Aegean, which was a superb seafood restaurant, where you could have something very simple or very elaborate or traditional. There were a number of restaurants like that. The Coach House, absolutely, which was a superb restaurant. Even delis, there used to be one in the Village, which we call the 8th Street Deli, or otherwise known as Davis's, at the foot of McDougal and 8th Street, would be very welcome back. There are so many that I have seen come and go, and though we have some very good ones now, we may have a bigger variety, it was not without certain losses.
Sure. I'm wondering, nowadays, do you check out new restaurants as much as you used to? Do you prefer going to sort of tried and true places?
Not as much as I used to, because it's expensive and the New York Times isn't paying for it anymore. But I do try and keep up, especially with those that seem that they'll probably be lasting, like Gatto, I think, has been wonderful. Elan, I've enjoyed very much. Al Onda, I thought, was very good. And I also like a lot of the ethnic cuisines that we have more of now in easily attainable ways. For example, Hanjan is a much more pleasurable Korean restaurant for someone who is not really into the language and all kinds of things that you find in Koreatown.
Sure.
So I do try to keep up, and I would even go to Brooklyn if they took reservations and I could take a cab. I can't see riding the subway and then waiting 2 hours to get
on. I understand. I
like Asian cuisines. I do particularly try to follow Thai and Chinese, and I deplore the fact that there's no good Chinese restaurant in Greenwich Village.
I would agree. These days, how much would you say you go out to restaurants versus cook at home?
Well, my husband died in February, so that has changed my life somewhat. I'm home surely 3 nights a week now, in which I prepare something rather simple for myself. And I'm out, obviously, 4, but those 4 are not always ambitious restaurants. I live in a part of the Village that has a wide variety of modest, decent restaurants that it's fun to go to. I mean, a few I can get to without even crossing a single street.
So it's a good commute.
That's good in the icy weather. But and a couple would be something new or something ambitious.
And do you ever order takeout?
Once in a while, from Chinese or Indian. And recently I have taken out, but not ordered. I've gone and gotten a Mighty Quinn opened on Greenwich Avenue near me, and I get some of their meats that I use with vegetables that I prepare. I don't like their sides, but I like the brisket and the ribs.
That's great. That's a good way, sort of half and half.
You know, make a whole chicken for myself, so I get a half of their barbecued chicken.
That sounds great. I'll come over. I'll split the other half with you. I want to talk about the re-release of the German cookbook, which just came out. It's celebrating its 50th anniversary.
I can't believe it.
Yeah. Does that time fly? Or?
It's been steadily in print for 50 years, and when I get a royalty check, I'm sure Random House has me mixed up with some other author, but I haven't complained. No, it's been, 2,500, 3,000 copies a year.
That's amazing.
For a really big, very serious, very traditional German cookbook. And I think that second, third, and fourth generation Germans who want to know the food of their immigrant forebears find it find it here.
Yeah, I love the subtitle of the book, which is A Complete Guide to Mastering Authentic German Cooking. I think there's a lot of authority in that title that I love.
I think it was a style when the book came out, because that was the same publisher in another division of Julia Child's book, which was Mastering the Art of French Cooking. And in fact, the sketches of the needed equipment was done by the same artist who did them for her book.
Yeah. No, they look very familiar.
Yeah, it was so Sidoni Charin or something was her name, a long, long time ago. But it's endured, and I've added a new preface, which includes something the original book did not have, a list of recommended German and Austrian restaurants in Austria, Germany, and around the United States, plus a few sources of one of my favorite German bake specialties, the Baumkuchen, which you can now get in several parts of the country.
Yeah, and you can order online.
That's right. And some of the sources for the best sausages and a few other exotic ingredients. Now you can pretty much get anything, I think, from Amazon,
yeah.
Which is a writer I'm not supposed to promote, but... Boy, they really have it. I mean, if I found Moravian cherry jam on Amazon, what can't you find?
I feel like, what's the Fairway tagline? Like, if we don't have it, they don't make it or something like that. I think that belongs to Amazon now. I'm wondering what you think. I mean, this book is 50 years old, but it really stands the test of time. Are you hoping to attract a new audience with this re-release?
I think so, very much, because there are certain things inherent and very traditional in German cooking that are looking fashionable to us now, the whole trend to nose-to-tail cooking. Of course, Germans, as well as any farmers, any place, butchers, any place, use the whole animal, including the blood, to be cooked into sausages, mm-hmm. or the Italians make it into a chocolate pudding like dessert, etc. But it's very traditional with German, and this book has recipes for all the parts. Also, being a wintry country, Germany has long depended upon root vegetables that suddenly we're hearing parsnip and turnip and rutabaga, which is like what else is new in Germany. Ditto for all the cabbage family, whether as cabbage or as sauerkraut or in various forms.
I think there's something.
And the great baking.
Oh, of course,
The breads are fantastic in Germany. They've always had a penchant for whole grains, dark breads, and breads with real character.
Yeah. And all these things that sort of are having this new life of being kind of hip, and what's new is actually really, really old.
Right. I will say one of the chefs who has done a great deal to make Austro-German cooking better known and appreciated is Kurt Guttenbrunner, who at Walsee, Blaue Gans, and especially, I think, Café Sabarsky in the Neue Gallery, has put a slightly different look, but the very traditional flavors on dishes, which happened many years before at a place called Vienna 79, to which I gave 4 stars when I was at the Times. It had been opened a year. I never heard about it. Finally, I did, and I was blown away by the modern presentation of the very traditional foods. And that man now has Peter Grunauer, a restaurant in Kansas City called Grunauer.
Oh, which you mentioned on the list.
That's right.
Yeah. So wonderful. I'm curious, as someone who writes and who writes cookbooks, and I develop and I test recipes, did you make every single thing in here?
Every single thing.
Wow.
Every single thing. And to be honest, there are no bread recipes in there. There's everything else, but I did not do the breads for that book.
Leave it to the
I made everything at least twice.
Yeah.
And I still do a lot of the Christmas cookies.
I was about to ask, what do you still cook out of this book?
I cook very much sauerbraten, and I cook another version of it, which instead of being marinated in wine and vinegar, is marinated in beer. I like that very much. It's a softer, maltier taste, not unlike carbonade flamande. I make the roast baby chickens stuffed with curry rice. I make parsnip fritters. I do a lot of the baking and a lot of the desserts. There's a hot chocolate pudding dessert called Frankfurter pudding that you steam in a melon mold, and it's fabulous.
What's a melon mold?
It's a mold that looks like half a
melon. That's exactly what it sounds like.
Looks like half a melon. It looks like half of a ridged football. And it's a steaming, a bomb steamer. And this hot chocolate pudding comes out. You put some whipped cream on it or chocolate sauce. The desserts are really, really wonderful. And I do a lot of the baking of the pound cakes. Yeah. I don't like gooey cake, but I do like pound cakes and yeast coffee cakes.
Like a good Brooklyn girl.
Used to be a place called Ebinger's that had a lot of that German style.
We're not allowed to say Ebinger's in my family. It's the rival. I wanted to talk about your other book, which is coming up. It'll be released in early 2015. 1,000 Foods to Eat Before You Die, a Food Lover's Life List, which is based on the model of 1,000 Places to See Before You Die.
Right. It's the same format, the same look, the same franchise, Workman.
Yeah. I'm wondering how it all came about. Did Workman approach you or vice versa?
No. I was at the Goddard Riverside fundraising dinners. Because at that time my memoir came out, Eating My Words, and
best title ever.
And I was seated at this is a series of dinners at rich people's houses, prestigious people's houses, with various authors whose books have come out that year. People pay a lot of money for the dinner, and the money goes to Goddard Riverside. And I was at a table with Patricia Schultz, who wrote 1,000 Places to See. And she gave me a copy, and I went home that night, and I thought, why not 1,000 Foods? So I thought it over for a few days, my husband saying, you're out of your mind. And I then called Peter Workman. I didn't know him, but I knew who he was, and he knew who I was. And I said, how about this? I did know Suzanne Rafer, who is one of the main editors there. And together we made an appointment, and we began to talk about it. And finally, we agreed. When they agreed on the amount of the advance I wanted, we started. And I'm very sad that Peter Workman is no longer alive to see the fruition of something he had so much confidence
in.
And then, of course, I had to make a list. So I think I started close to 1,400.
And this was 10 years ago, right? You've been 10
years
it for
ago.
The past decade. Yeah.
But not every day for 10 years.
You have to take a break from the list.
Yeah, like 2 years.
That's so funny. And you started with, was it 1,400 things? And you had
about 13, 14, knowing some would fall by the wayside. And in fact, others presented themselves and some fell by the wayside.
And have you eaten all 1,000 things?
I've eaten 90%, which I say in the book that I still have something to aspire to.
It's good to leave, to, you know.
And,
you know,
many of them
want.
Are meals inspired by paintings or books I've read. And I guess mostly that. And I've made meals out of them.
So wonderful.
Yeah.
That sounds really great. I can't wait for it to come out.
Me too.
So just a couple of months, it's around the corner, which is hard to believe. Speaking of things you'd like to eat, before we go, I've left a few minutes for the what I call the Cherry Bomb Rapid Fire Q&A. It's the 7 questions I ask every guest who comes on. There's no pressure, no worries, just whatever first comes to mind. Okay. Mimi, number one, sweet or salty?
Salty.
What did you have for breakfast today?
Pecan coffee ring that my daughter-in-law brought down from a bakery in Saratoga where I love the baker.
That sounds great. if I were to look into your refrigerator right now, what might I be surprised to find?
Lentil soup with knackwurst. What else would you be surprised? Maybe be surprised what not to find, which is very much food at the moment. But
that, I feel like on a Monday that happens. What's your go-to snack?
My go-to snack, salami. Mm.
What's your favorite time of day?
Morning.
Any particular hour or just?
No, around 7:30, 8 o'clock.
Where do you want to travel to next?
Berlin.
Mm. And what was your favorite meal when you were a kid?
Boy. Fried eggs.
That's still one of your favorite things.
Yeah, well, roast duck with kosher.
Oh, wow.
I like that. My grandmother made it, and in Yiddish, duck is kachka and kasha. And as a little kid, I was always mixed up, and I would say to my mother, which is the kachka and which is the kasha? So I think of it whenever I cook kasha, which is often, because I love it.
That's so funny. That's really great. Mimi, thank you so much for coming on. It means so much. I have to make one quick announcement before we go, which is about Molly Culver, who's a farmer here in Brooklyn, who was a guest on the first season of Radio Cherry Bomb. She's organized a fundraiser for the youth farm at the High School for Public Service. It's called Meet Your Maker, and it's happening this Thursday, November 6th, at 61 local public house in Cobble Hill. And dinner is going to be served at 6 and again at 8. And the meal is going to be prepared by Rob Newton of Nightingale 9 and Wilma Jean, who is very special to us at Cherry Bomb. Also, the chefs from Martha and Brucey, and ingredients will be from the farm. Tickets are available at hspsfarm.blogspot.com, and proceeds will go to the farm. Mimi, I have to thank you again one more
time.
Thank
you
very
much.
This is really great. It's an honor to have you on. And I encourage everyone to look for the German cookbook, the new edition, and in January or February, 1,000 Foods to Eat Before You Die. And as always, thank you everyone for listening. Tune in next Monday at 1 o'clock for another episode of Radio Cherry Bomb.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.